What we'll do is we'll start with less. Do you have a PowerPoint?
Actually,
you don't want to do it.
If I could close, because I've actually got something that
okay.
I'd like to
all right.
put forward.
All right, Dan, are you ready?
You're right.
You
rock, paper, scissors, and whoever loses has to start.
All right. Well,
let me just outline kind of an intro. The reason why we set this topic, paradigm, heritage, and economic crisis, survival, and growth strategies, is that we're all going through this right now. So I thought it would be useful to hear what individuals and their organizations are doing in the face of economic crisis. So I think we need to look at four key questions. How has the current economic crisis impacted or affected your organization in terms of budget, staff, program? What is your organization doing to survive and sustain itself in this crisis time? What opportunities as a result of crisis have been presented by this being in this situation, and what creative continued growth and redevelopment strategies have you developed to take advantage of these opportunities? So that's kind of what we want to talk about, and so we have four great panelists and their organizations to talk about this. So we'll start off with Stan, and then we'll probably go to our host, to go to Sam, and then Bethany, and then Les wants to bat cleanup. So Stan?
All right, so three questions. How it has impacted us. Well, I don't think we're any different than anybody else in saying that the impact has been significant. We're an organization that has changed so fast, I can't go back and say, well, compared to last year, this is what's happening this year, because last year is no comparison in so many ways to this year. But there's no question in my mind that it has impacted us, and the steps that we've taken. The primary step is the bulk of our budget is in people. So on average, we've taken a 10% pay cut across the board. We're still keeping all of our benefits, but depending on how this next round hits as far as medical is concerned, we may be having our staff pick up a portion of its benefit package. Then going into I said what we're doing to survive. We took some cuts. And opportunities as a result, I think the biggest one was luck, pure luck, that we just started this big campaign right on the cusp of when things started to happen with the economy. And then looking at strategies, it's kind of what the advice that we're getting is you kind of go back to the basics. Where does your fundraising what's at the core of it? And the old adage that people give to people is fundamental. It's really about relationships. There's no magic bullet out there. It's about relationships. And we've always known that. I think as far as our capital campaign is concerned, we have $430,000 to go, which I mentioned. We're not going to go out and go to somebody new. We're not likely anyway, you never know, but you're not likely to go to somebody new and say, we're looking for a six-figure gift from you. Virtually all of those big donors are already donors. They're people that we have that gave to us 4 or 5 years ago to kick off the campaign, and we've been cultivating them all the way along, and the kind of the basic pitch is, you got to start it, and we've made good on the promises that we made to you. Here we are at the end. And can you help us a little bit more to get there? I'm going to skip around a little bit, but the broad picture of relationships, you kind of think it's picking up the telephone and calling somebody or handshaking and meeting them at receptions, and that's all really important. But as an ED, there's no way you can do that enough. You depend upon your family, and the closest family in around you is your staff, and understanding that when a person walks in the door, everybody needs to understand that person could be a $600,000 donor, and treat them like that. And then the next group that surrounds you is your board, and your board has to be out there talking positively, be positively about you all the time and building those relationships. And you know, I use the metaphor of a family, and there's those that are in tight that live, work, leave the organization, and then they start moving out. You got a circle of members that surround you. You got a circle of via what I call our VIP mailing list, which they haven't become members yet, but somehow their names exist in your file, so they're being cultivated. And then you've got the ones beyond that, the visitors that maybe walk in. You don't know who they are, but how you treat them and whatnot. Those are the physical building of relationships that lead to good fundraising. And then it's the media part of it too. When a member gives a donation, being sure to put a little personal note on that thank you that you send back to them. Something that, you know, maybe the same personal note you write 1,000 times, but you write it, you handwrite it yourself so that they see it. You know, and it's also embracing a lot of these new media. Older donors don't necessarily, aren't necessarily aware of it, but younger ones certainly are. But in the Twitter and the Facebook and all of that, who knows where it's going to go. But it's incumbent upon all of us to kind of keep up with it and at least stay in the game. You know, get yourself those accounts and kind of get somebody that's going to make a posting every once in a while to keep yourself visible to those new donors and new people that are contacting you. And there was one other thing I was going to mention that I think has made a difference for us. You know, nonprofits have to be businesslike as much as a regular business. And I say, I often tell a staff member that really the only difference between us and a used car lot down the street is that we don't have to make a profit and they do. But if we don't, we have to run ourselves every bit as tight and with every bit as much attention to budgets and costs and benefits as they do, or we won't survive. I constantly, throughout my career, but even now more so than ever, have to fight the accounting system that the government tries to impose on nonprofits, which essentially says divide you up into the money you spend for program and the money you don't spend for program. You know, you're supposed to keep yourself somewhere in that 20% overhead and 80% program. There is no accounting system. If you keep your books that way, it's not a business-like way to manage it. What you need to do is build, or what I find needed to do is find my profit centers and build a budget around that profit center. So the person managing it has the information they need in order to manage that in a business-like way. So I strip out of their budget everything that they can't control. The person who is managing a retail store or a conference center, a conference space or whatever, even educational programs, strip away what things that they can't control. So they're, when they look at it, it's just the things that they have a management over. And then as the monthly reports come out, as you go along and each of the monthly reports come out, you can sit down with them and if whatever the numbers are, they created them. They made them. If there's revenue there, they produce that revenue. If there are expenses there, they produce those expenses. That means at the end, a whole lot of things, heat, light, electricity, insurance, accounting, so many things fall back into G&A. At the end of our year, the internal books that I keep for my reference and for working with my staff shows about 60% in overhead and the rest of it in program. So then we go through this machination of saying, well, okay, how much of those utilities went into the program? How many of the utilities went in like that? If you start out that way, your bookkeeper gets a utility bill. In my case, I've got 6 different profit centers. They take that utility bill and they gotta put it into 6 different places. And I don't do it that way. I keep the utility bill in one spot. Then we dispute when we write out the 990 and create our annual report. We make up what we think works, and that's what you see when we print an annual report. I don't know how, that's kind of quick, and I'm not sure how much I'm communicating here. We can ask questions later, but I'll stop at that point.
Okay, sounds good. And Stan will talk about Columbia River Management Museum.
Okay. Well, this is the first
most of you know that I was hired recently, and to replace Jerry Ostermiller, who actually created the whole organization as you see it now. So he left me in an incredibly good position for any nonprofit, for the benefit of our visiting reporter. I'd like to say that while we appear to be wealthy and we have an incredibly fine facility and all of our exhibits and so forth are of world class, and I can truly say that without having made no input into them yet, we still run a very tight ship and our budget is exceedingly fine, just like it is for everybody else. Nevertheless, I can still say that we are in the black. We have been in the black for all 48 years of our existence so far, and fortunately I can say that we have never had to borrow money externally. That's due largely to the policies of the board. It's a very strong board, and the board has maintained a policy of sort of pay as you go. You do not do anything that you cannot afford to pay for at the time. And that is causing me some angst right now, which I'll get into. But nevertheless, it is still a very good policy. It does not allow you to move yourself into any kind of financial jeopardy. First question, I guess, was how does the current economic crisis impact the Maritime Museum? Our budget is exceedingly tight. As I said, we don't zero-base budget every year. We build on what we've done in the past. But we look over everything very, very carefully, and you do not want to sit in on the budget meetings with the board if you're in my position. It's not fun. They are asked very detailed questions and make sure that every dime is clearly accounted for. One of the problems that I have, and I can't really answer your questions too carefully about how well we're doing or not doing, is that with when they hired me, this is the first time, well, first of all, I was hired as executive director. Prior to that point, Jerry was executive director, but we did not have a deputy director. And so Jerry had to do everything from running the operations of the building and museum to the actual fundraising and be the outside person. And when they asked me how much time I expected to spend fundraising, I said 60 to 80% of my time. And that with that, there was no way that I could also run the operations of this organization. So we hired, promoted actually Dave Pearson, who's been the curator for 14 years, to another position. So instead of actually cutting staff and cutting salaries, we've actually increased our staff because we promoted Dave to a much higher level job, so we have to accommodate him accordingly. And then we had to promote his assistant curator, and now we have to hire another curator. So we've actually maybe increased our staff by one and a half people, if you want to count his salary and the assistant. So instead of, like most people, cutting staff, we've actually increased staff a bit. Along the same lines, however, we have frozen all salaries. The salaries have been frozen this year and last year, and I believe maybe even the year before that. A couple increases due to changes in staff job positions and things like that. But by and large, our finances are pretty well frozen, so that we indeed can survive and sustain ourselves as we go forward. I was looking at our figures. We normally say that we have about 100,000 visitors a year, admissions. And this year, we've had about 85,000. That's down, but that's what's kind of consistent with the Oregon High Desert Museum, the Oregon Historical Society. Most of the major venues in the state are down about that same level. What has kept us alive is the fact that we've increased our rather modest admission fee of $8 to $10 a person. And we have not seen that that has had any negative impact on our visitorship in the sense that anybody complains about it. Just that people aren't spending as much money that way. I think the brightest part of our financial picture here has to do with our museum store at Blue Anderson. Blue has taken a store that had an incredible inventory backlog and reduced the inventory by at least 50%, and at the same time, she's increased our sales per person, both in terms, well, how do I say that? Per person net sales by about 35%.
So even though our admissions are down, pretty much everybody who comes through the door ends up going through the museum store. And based upon her marketing skills, the way she's got the museum store laid out and so forth, has increased the revenue from that revenue source for us. So it's been very beneficial to us. One of the things that you say, one of the other questions are, what kind of opportunities do we have and what kinds of ways are we dealing with the bad economy? I should tell you a story. That when I first came to Oregon as a director of the Niche Conservancy in the 80s, I didn't realize that we were faced at that time with the same kind of economy we have now. It was just as bad. And I looked at it then, and I look at it now, as yes, it's a bad economy, but there's still a lot of people out there with money. There's still a lot of foundations that have to give money away. If you have a good story to tell and you do your job well, you will prosper and survive. And that's the attitude I take. I don't take it, let's withdraw, step back and circle the wagons, I'm saying, let's expand. And from that perspective, when the board hired me, they brought me on to build on what Jerry had done and to move this organization to another level of academic excellence, to another level of prestige, to increase its reputation and, presence both regionally, and nationally, and even internationally. That was the goal. That's what they told me they wanted me to do. Also raise a lot of money for it, but so we'll get there. So one of the first things I found when I came is that we didn't really have all the tools we needed to raise money and to be able to tell the story of the museum very well. For instance, we didn't even have a campus map chart so that I could walk into some donor and say, you know, here's what we've got. I mean, Dick, being an architect, you can create wonderful things. I envy that skill. So you have campus map knowledge to tell your story. So when I got here, as I said, the main museum is operating well. We have exhibits that are incredibly fine. There's not a lot that I need to do to make this facility here run well. Dave and the rest of the staff, incredibly good staff, operate this place in an incredibly efficient way. And if I start putting my fingers here and there and tinker, all I'm likely to do is mess it up. So where am I supposed to put my time? We leave this alone. If you look at the other parts, we have the train depot that was given to the Maritime Museum in 1985 by Burlington Northern. We have an armory over here, 40,000 square feet, and we have about 13 acres of campus here to do things with. And so my goals right now, aside are, and they're all kind of interlinked, is that I look at the train depot and I say, boat shop, got to fix it up, got to rehabilitate it. We either fix it up or it's going to fall down, and that's not acceptable to the community, it's not acceptable to the board. So one of my first goals and priorities is to get the depot, what I call rehabilitated, to a workshop or warehouse standard, where I can have boat classes there, boat building classes, but more importantly, what I want to do is call it a center for traditional maritime skills and trades. And the idea here would be that certainly there would be boat building, boat restoration, boat documentation programs here. But we have so many skills available in this whole Lower Columbia region that are going extinct, that need to be captured before they go extinct, that this is the perfect venue for it. So what I would do there is involve people, for instance, net makers. We have net makers, people still alive who not only know how to repair nets, but know how to make all the various kinds of gill nets that are out there. I was just visiting somebody in Skamakawe, and he opens a drawer, and there must have been 200 net needles in there, many of which he made. And each one was of a different size. You know, I look, I mean, all net needles, right? No. Every one of those had its own name, its own function, its own purpose. And that's not in the literature. It's not documented at all. So fix the depot up. Start doing demonstrations of net making. That's one instance. Start doing documenting the net making process and the tools and the way in which those tools are used. And then that leads back to the main museum, where I produce then a series of occasional papers or monographs under our imprint, which are scholarly and not necessarily generally designed for the general public, but are furthering the mission of this organization, which is to preserve the heritage of the region. and make sure that it's available to the general public if they're interested. So along those lines, then, this is going to be an area that is going to become first of a center for activities as opposed to the more passive uses in the main building. So we have more passive uses here, more active uses down here. This is going to feed in intellectual information into a publishing program that we'll be establishing that will move us in towards an academic excellence another layer there. At the same time, we talked about the small craft conference that I started, or we're going to be holding in March. The idea there is to identify what are the boats of the region, and which ones do we need to protect, and which ones do we need to document. And once we have that, and we all have it collectively, we can look on the boats of this region and say, which of those boats should we start documenting, and which ones should be preserved and added to our collection. Again, the boat documentation stuff will be fed into a publication program, again, increasing our ability to reach out. Some of those boats, however, we want to preserve. That's where the armory comes in. We have 40,000 square feet. We've climate controlled the basement, 20,000 square feet, just like the armory that you have. It's got huge high ceilings, big area. There's no reason why we can't set up a boat, just a public boat storage area, that is, the public can wander around. But it's still basically a storage area, very much like what you see in Douarnenez, France, at the Maritime Museum there. This is going to feed boats and other materials mm-hmm. into this, and over time it's going to increase the pressure and the raison d'etre to raise money for this. Right now there's no real reason why anybody should give to us for the armory because we're not using it effectively. But when the pressure starts building to use that, then we'll be able to move ahead. So, for me, all of these things all blend together. We're going to be doing new exhibits. There's this interesting yin and yang and tension between urban and rural museums. Everybody wants to see you have many exhibits, frequent exhibits. But as Jerry pointed out to me, we're basically a rural museum. And the bulk of our visitors are from away. And people from away don't really need to see rapidly changing exhibits because they're expensive. And then don't come that often, so they're not going to really notice that we haven't changed our exhibits. And it would be nice to satisfy the local community with rapidly changing exhibits, but when your community is limited to roughly 10,000 people, and those are expensive rotations to do, you shy away from that. We're coming to a sort of an intermediate ground in that area by having this room. Right now we have some Hank Bender art here. We've had three other small art exhibits in here. We have using this room more and more for very small, quickly rotating exhibits to which we invite the local community. It's been very, very successful. They highly well-attended events. So it serves the local community in a way we haven't been serving them before. They're starting to support us in a more generous way. And yet we're still satisfying the needs of the people from away. It all blends together in my mind. It's all together. I think one of the challenges, the biggest challenge for me is, well, first of all of the funding stuff that I've been talking about here, we divided into two sections. We divided our funding into generally operational expenses and program expenses. And of course, my training, as many of you know, is with the Nature Conservancy, which is almost focused entirely on programs. So program fundraising is much easier than operational fundraising. Fortunately for us, most, I'd say, 80% of our operational money comes from our admissions. And so we're pretty well covered there. I don't have to worry too much about that. That's a great blessing. But the programs are all have to be raised. We have to raise money for those directly without going further. And one other thing I forgot to tell you about was the other thing we have, and this is why when I mentioned to you and Everett, make sure that you, when you accept a gift of something, that you always make sure that it's got a little endowment. This was the pilot boat Peacock that was given to the museum before I came by the bar pilots. Today, about say 2009, late 1999. It's a 90-foot, specially built, modified rescue ship from Germany, North Sea rescue ship, modified for use on the Columbia River, worked on the Columbia River for almost 33 years, and used by the bar pilots in winter conditions to deliver the bar pilots out. We accepted this boat with the understanding that we were going to display it, restore it, display it, and interpret it. Well, there was no endowment with it. And so what that meant, there was no money really given at all to do the restoration and so forth. To get this boat on land, there was quite a bit of discussion whether it should be left in the water like a lightship, or to put on pilings over the water, or to put on land. From a curatorial perspective, it's better on land. And you would think it would be inexpensive. As of Friday, I think the estimated cost of restoring this, getting it repaired, getting it sighted, moving it from just the water over to the far corner of our campus, is going to cost about $250,000. And it's not exactly the prettiest boat in the world, but I will say I finally come around to the bar pilot's point of view that if you were to name any single vessel as being the most critical and most important single vessel to operate ever on the Columbia River, this would be it. More so than the Columbia Rediviva, more so than any other single vessel, because over a 33-year period, this boat has enabled the bar pilots to be able to get out to the freighters and have reduced the number of bar closures to about 2 or 3 or 4 a year. And if they hadn't done that, we would have, the whole Port of Portland, Port of Vancouver, Kalama, Longview, all the way to the whole Columbia River Basin economy would have been different, because most of the vessels probably would have gone to Tacoma, to Bellingham, to Seattle, to other places. So the maritime trades, maritime economy of the region was dependent on this single ship. I didn't realize that when I first started looking at it until I started thinking about what it did do. Over a 10-year period, we get, or about a year, we get about 4,000 freighters crossing here a year. This boat, 30 years, 4 times 30 is 120,000 ships. This boat visited every single one of them at least twice. So it does deserve its due, its day and protection. But it's not any expensive. Yeah,
on the issue of getting an endowment at the same time as you accept an object, I am thinking, I read in the paper up in Seattle, something that you acquired this summer where you did get an endowment with it.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That was the Wendt map collection. This is one of those stories that you wish you could repeat, so I sort of envy you with your anonymous $2 million gift. But Mr. Wendt is an incredible map collector, and he put together a collection through Sonoma Museum on mapping the Pacific coast, trying to find the Columbia River. And using maps going back from 1544 all the way up to 1802. And basically, these were the maps and charts that Jefferson used to make his decisions about sending Lewis and Clark out. So he put together this exhibit with some professionals, put a book out. We have a book for sale. And when I was back at Mystic Seaport, Sam Devlin said, "Hey, have you seen the exhibit here at Mystic of Henry stuff?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you had it at your museum. Why don't you go look?" I said, "You ought to go talk to Henry. Henry, I built both for Henry, and he really liked your museum. And he might like to give you those." So I hopped it up to Friday Harbor and had some friends set up a dinner. And at the end of the dinner, a couple of balls of wine, that was done. So, sort of done. And so I figured out that we needed an endowment for this, so we can use this for educational purposes, outreach and things. And I figured out we needed roughly $15,000 a year, and that works out to be about $250,000 endowment. I didn't tell him that, I just said we need roughly $50,000 a year. He emails me back and says, "Sounds like you need you need an endowment. Does $350,000 sound agreeable to you?" I was anticipating that he'd probably get a $50,000 or maybe $25,000, something like that. he went on the other direction. So he's a very generous man. But again, that money is tied up. It is endowed. We cannot use it for any except for the educational purposes relating to those masks. But again, a way of another creative way of using this is that some of that money will support our education person or outreach person. And he's also funding through this an idea I had, what I call one-night stands. We're going to make the G. Clay Prince of filament mask, take maybe one original, and we will contact people throughout the United States, but predominantly in Oregon, Washington, and predominantly in my mind on the east side, where they don't really see much of maritime history. And we will pay for us to go to some site and give a lecture. And that will satisfy Mr. Wendt in terms of getting his knowledge of his maps out. We can build lectures around the maps. They don't always have to focus on the map. They can talk about economic trade routes and all sorts of things like that. Where we can use it and piggyback though on it is that I can figure out who in those communities are people that are of interest for us in terms of prospects for donors and have a nice evening with a cocktail party and whatnot. They can actually see the original map up close and not quite touch it, but very close. So we can use it to not only academically or meet Mr. Wendt's needs for spreading the word about his collection, but we can use it also from a donor cultivation tool. So that kind of covers it. What opportunities do we have? We have lots of opportunities and we're trying to seize them. One of the problems with the depot, for instance, that'll probably cost us $800 to $1 million to upgrade that. And the board finally decided to, against my recommendation, to allocate $50,000 for the startup cost so that we could indeed get all of the surveys done and the engineering work done so I'd know what the cost would be, then I can then go to donor to it. So I was going to bootstrap myself all the way up, my flowchart and all that. They said, no, let's make it a little easier on you. Let's give you $50,000 to hire an architect and the engineers and so on to get that work done. But after that, it's all bootstrapping, but it's a project, it's a good project, and it's just how well I tell the story. That's it.
Great. Thank you, Sam. And Betsy Davis from the Center for Wooden Boats.
Oh. Do you mind putting the screen down? This is a document that's from the website. You can download it for free. It's a PDF. And I found it to be a helpful summary about responding to this economy. And many of these things are things that the previous speakers have already talked about. The whole idea, number one, act quickly, not reflexively, plan contingencies. The second one Stan talks about, protect the core. Third, identify the people who matter most and keep that group strong. I think a lot of folks are saying in this economy, put the effort into stewarding the people you know. Stay close to your key funders. Shape up your organization. Involve your board. Communicate openly and often. So I thought that was great overall advice. And now I'm going to tell you what can go wrong.
One nice thing about Betsy is she knows more about computers than anybody else in this room. Not a problem for her to manage
stuff. So we've been learning a lot at the center this year, and I guess maybe the economy had a bigger impact on us than it did on some of the previous speakers. We had to cut a lot, we had to think about it a lot, and these are some of our big lessons learned. Budget conservatively and figure out ahead of time what the points are before we calibrate. And I'm going to spend a fair chunk talking about monitoring the cash flow. We're a $1.5 million budget, but cash flows are always right on the line. So, and then engaging folks in the process and so forth, nothing like the cash reserve and the reasonable tools on the web. So I just want to say, and I'm sorry to review for people, but we do get audited, and so we keep our books using GAAP, generally accounted, accepted accounting principles, so that means they're accrual based. I am here to say CWD would not have survived last year without a cash budget and a cash view against that budget. So in essence, we are creating two sets of reconciled. And I just use this as an example. Let's say this is a given month. Accrual basis, if you look at the income for that month, it's awesome because we got a workshop fee and membership. Someone donated the boat, and because GAAP means you have to record the income value, you record it when we get it. I'm going to pledge for over two years, and there's no conditions on it, so we get to record that. I mean, we have to record that. Oh, and we got a check-in, and we're going to use it to pay the youth program staff. And so that's cool. And you know, someone owes us $4,500. How cool. We know that. So accrual basis, it looks like we had a wildly successful month. Cash life, I have to go write a check. And I only have $345 or whatever. So that's a dramatic view of it, but that's what we say in our organization. Okay, so last year, going into 2009, what we said is very conservative. Boy, we think that we should predict our income's going to be down. And we chose scenario one. We said our income's going to be down, okay, painful. We had $150,000 worth of expenses. And you know what? It turned out that we were closer to scenario three. We weren't conservative enough when we went into 2009. But at least we tried. And you have to understand this whole thing, but all this is to say is when we went into 2009, we said there's all sorts of points along the way where we're going to look and see how we did and recalibrate if we have to. And the sad thing is we have to do it all day long because we weren't conservative enough. So, for instance, our auction happened at some point, and so we say, okay, how did we do an auction? And ahead of time we said, if we don't do a warmer auction, we're not going to catch that. So this, you don't have to go into details, but just this whole idea of having milestones coming in here. So at one point, we had $132,000 from our budget and expenses. And you'll see, it's across the board. Staffing, printing, copying, no more training, no more wooden work, fewer wooden boat ads, postage, all sorts of things. But the day thing was, we were still, as of July, we're still going to be in the hole by $100,000, even after doing all that. So in July, this is what our board sees. This is our cash-based budget. And we say our budget, where we're supposed to be at that point in July, was a positive $81,000, and where we were was a positive $21,000. You know, it's not good, but it doesn't sound that bad. Well, this is why forecasting cash flow has been important for us. As of July, it looks like we're going to be in the hole by $100,000 at the end of the year. Oh, but maybe it'll get better. So in August, oh, great. I am really happy to tell you that because we looked at this in July and did this forward-looking cash forecast, we ended the year cash positive and accrual net income positive. But that's because we did a hell of a lot starting in August to reduce our expenses. Some places we increased income, a few life opportunities emerged, but this is really about managing super closely all the details. So around August, we said, how can we change the bottom line? We can obviously increase the donations. We can increase our earnings. We can cut expenses. We can use the surplus that we had built into our budget that year. Or we can cut some of our operations work and instead focus those resources on our capital campaign. You know, the place I really wanted to do things were one and two. Because then we wouldn't have to make some of the tough calls. But we didn't let ourselves go there. I mean, sure, we're trying to, you know, market our programs and look for opportunity. But we really had to nail it. So where we really spent time at that point on cutting expenses, we decided to use the cash surplus that we had built into our budget, and we did shift, and we cut some of our programs to shift certain resources over to our campaign. We did a whole other laundry list of cuts that I'm not going to go into, but I think bottom line, our whole organization was involved in this. It wasn't a top-down thing from the board or from me, but really, what the board had to do is establish a framework within which we could make, the staff could make the cuts. And they, in our case, said preserve core programs, maintain quality over quantity. They felt that quality of the staff was something we needed to maintain, and we need to cut things in a way that can regrow those programs, regrow the critical health that they need. And then the staff, each staff person in their area, essentially looks and said, okay, how can I cut? And it's so important to keep mission in mind. You know, it's not just about money, it's always this calculus. And so our youngest staff member, created a 2x2 grid that has mission on one side and expense to the organization on the other. And obviously, if it's low cost, high mission, you keep it. If it's high cost, low mission, it goes away. And then the other ones are where we have conversations. We, the staff, and, at various times, go back to the board and present quote a menu of that. So for the things that have been moved, call them the entrees and the small ones, so that side, you can forget what we call the number ones. We use that for budgeting too. But through this process, you know, I think we have a problem where at one point we got to a place where our development manager goes, gee, the board won't do what they're supposed to do. And the board's going, gee, the development manager is doing what they're supposed to do. I don't know if any other nonprofit goes through this. And so we found that we needed to change our approach to working with board members. Because they're volunteers, and sometimes they want it all. So we need to do a better job of listening to them, and each of them with their own communication style of how to do that. So I just wanted to say, we also found a lot of tools on the internet. There's an article that I just handed you, and then I just wanted to hand out this other one too. And this also is available online, and in a very nerdy moment, what I did, this is a list of financial strategies, and you'll see the big picture things like, you know, analyze purchasing, adjust payables, evaluate facilities and infrastructure, and it goes on. And I always like it when someone else has done the work for me, you can leave them alone. So then what we did is we used that just to go through the list to make sure we were thinking of everything, because we had to respond in a big way. And the title's going across is just the planning, or just the time period, because some things we've been doing forever, and some things we started during this crunch, and some things we held off and said we're going to use for parts of 2010. So I won't go through the details of this, but if anybody wants to know more nerdy details, I'm happy to go through them. So just a couple high points. I think staffing and related costs is a really big area for us. It's a small group, but all of our budget is people. We're people intensive. So we cut salaries last January 3%. We did 2 furloughs this year. 2 weeks we closed the center and didn't pay anybody. And we did a hiring freeze. We didn't replace several people when they left. We combined positions. We moved to seasonal folks in some places. I think we still have left a very strong team, but man, we're lean. Reducing services is so hard. And in general, we incrementally scale things down instead of cutting them all together. So like, you know, when the festival still happens, but it's 2 days instead of 3, 4, or 5 days. And last year, we actually got the same attendance and revenue at 2 days than we had previously at more days, because we kept it focused. And there's other places where we cut programs. The program catalog, you see, looks a lot like last year's program catalog, and actually we cut 45% lower in terms of the number of class hours that we're offering, and so we're really trying to focus on the classes that feel like Sam's brunch.
How many of those there are?
say that is we're very seasonal, so I have one person on a 9-month contract, several people on 10-month contracts, some people 2 days a week, some people 5 hours a week. So if I got peak 2 summers ago, I know it's broken at 39 people on the table. That includes 6 AmeriCorps and 4 new sailings and so forth. So I'm going to say maybe 2 years ago we had 18 full-time equivalents, and now we have 15 or 14, something like that. And we plan to grow again. Let's see. Services, we've talked about fees, other speakers have spoken about. For better or for worse, we don't have admission, so we have suffered from a decrease in visitors, so we don't rely on that. Similarly, we didn't lose a lot financially because we didn't have a big endowment. That's some of the stats. Okay, fundraising, big deal, big deal. Talk forever about that. We talked about services. Productivity, I think the biggest places we've seen increased productivity is smart use of online tools and media. Modifying the organization's culture. You know, we sort of, I think Dick's always had a philosophy, at least since I've been there, of whatever we have to share, but we really work hard on collaboration, and it's not just because we're nice, it's because we take our self-interest. I mean, our survival requires that. The engagement strategies from other nonprofits in the community. And you'll see, under 2010, engaging the business community is something we want to do even more. We sit on the doorstep of, you know, several million dollars worth of investment in South Virginia, and we have to really fight with that. So, that is that. And in summary, these are the things we can
That spreadsheet, was it on the website or something?
The spreadsheet is the document I just handed you, and if you wanted the one annotated, I mean, copy and paste it, it will do it.
Betsy, did you do this yourself, or did you do this in conjunction with consultants, or in the future with the kids?
We did not use consultants, but I think as an organization, we've gotten a lot more sophisticated around our financial stuff for two reasons. And one is two board members in particular helped drive us there. And the second is we hired a finance manager at the expense of other positions. And that person came in from the for-profit sector with all the tools that we have talked about. And she actually said this is way harder to do the nonprofit financial analysis because of things like restricted funds and how we do reimbursements and so forth. But anyway, she works for T-Mobile, she sees the big numbers, and our board president prior was the treasurer, we worked for Nordstrom, he's the treasurer of Nordstrom, and then we also have a great finance guy. We used to be at WAMU, we used to be elsewhere, but they just kept pushing on me, like, for 5 years. We can make numbers that we can actually make decisions from. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. I don't know. Well, you might run the board with the center. It was like, well, we kind of know these numbers. And we're monthly with the board reviewing the cash basis. Now, right now, we can't afford a bookkeeper, so our finance person is doing all the bookkeeping too. And that means you can't do all this analysis. And we just reviewed with the board and said, we can't give you all the reports we've been doing on a monthly basis. So what can we do on a monthly basis versus a quarterly basis? Just because we don't know that.
Thanks, Betsy. Great program. How many of the others of you are utilizing your either board members you've had on board or new board members to do this kind of work for your organization?
And knowing what you know now, what would you pick a date earlier that you should have done something, and what would that have been? Or are you happy with, have you done things? See,
well,
we did this really well. This is just a good exercise, and you need to
I wish, no. I feel that
we made an educated guess going into 2009, but we underestimated how significant the impact would be. So in a crystal ball world, I guess if we could have predicted ahead of time, then it wouldn't have been quite so stressful a year where every trigger point we come to, we're like, oh, geez, we've got to do our contingency. How are we now? Oh, geez. The middle of the summer? Shit. So, but the thing I'm happy about is that we've built the tools to do contingency planning, and it's friggin' cash flow. Look at 6 months to 12 months. We know to do that now. So that, I guess those are the things.
What are you forecasting for 2010?
We created a very conservative budget for 2010, and we're budgeting about a $900,000 operating budget. And last year we closed at about $1.5 million, the year before $1.9 million, the year before $1.6 million, the year before $1.3
million. You're really taking a drastic cut.
What we decided this year is we're aiming down here. And then these trigger points, well, if we do better than we think, then we're going to go up instead of down. And we don't have a cash reserve. We were going to have one at the end of last year, but we spent it through the year. So I really want to build that. So if we get some extra money, we might spend it, but we might also create the cash reserve with it.
And how did your constituency, or did it vocalize a response?
Let's see. Constituents, visitors, visitors, members, volunteers, board, staff, and Dick, you can help me with this. I think every time that there was a scaling down of a program, there's people who were disappointed with that. With the festival, I mean, staff, Dick and others, all of us, we're like, no, not just 2 days, can we do 3 days? You know, and we look at the cost of the permits with the city and the tents and everything, it's like $7,000 a day incrementally, and we're like, we can't do it. And so, or we cut a program, you know, ugh, we can't do it. Or we can't take care of a boat, we can't put it back in service. So I think that's hard. In terms of staff, I think the good news is staff been involved. It's not been top down. They're the ones who look at their program areas and help make the trade-offs. The bad news, it's been wearing. I have a couple of staff people who said, Jesse, what's going to be fun again? And so other constituents, I think the board, it's hard to say the board since it's 18 different people with different values and different ways of taking in information and making decisions, but I think for the most part they feel like they've been informed along the way, that it was a tough year, and I can tell you they were really proud last Saturday when we told them we ended the year net positive. So does that answer the question?
Yeah,
I mean, it's not...
You know, it's, well, kind of way though, you know, we're in this, still in this steep hill climb where you're ramping up in a difficult time. We're still able to do that, mm-hmm. but you know, I like your analysis of, you know, picking and choosing on the, you know, going to the golf center and just saying that's what we're going to do.
And there's some things we still do. Money on these are mission important. We do free public rides. We make no money on that. In fact, we spend a lot of money on it. But it's core to our mission, and we're going to keep doing it. So it was really important to let the staff know that when we're doing the program analysis, we just want to know what are we putting into it and what are the expenses, what's the net. But that doesn't mean we're only choosing the programs with the highest net, because mission is so important in all the equations. Dick, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think our... I think we owe a lot to our members. We were cutting back. We told them we're going to cut back the program. And one of the reasons was because we didn't expect the income. And the other one was that
our facilities were built between 1983 and 1988. And our popularity has a price, and that is that everything gets worn down. So we decided to repair everything right now through the winter, so it will be all bright and shiny when the park opens. Mm-hmm. And or maybe even leave them to bright and shiny. But in any case, our members understood that and contributed, I think, most of the $500,000 that we raised for this through individual contributions. So I think it's a win-win for us, okay, them, and I know that when spring comes, everything is going to be the way it was before.
I think communication has become even more important for us, communicating with all our constituents. And one of the investments, even though we're scaling back in so many of our areas, is we've hired a 4-day-a-week person to help with communications. And so we have our new blog, our Twitters, our Facebooks, new collateral being made. And I think it just, and we need to do more communications. We have regular newsletter to our volunteers and so forth. And at least at the moment, that feels like a totally critical investment.
What's going to happen for the Wooden Boat Festival this summer? Because
Saturday, Sunday.
Huh?
It's going to be a Saturday and a Sunday.
Yeah, but I mean, where?
Most of the construction fences will be down, so the hardscape, although it could always change, but at the moment, the hardscape paths will be in. It's just a lot of the areas that will be cracked, can't be walked on because of it's growing still. So it'll probably be more space than we've had in some years past.
So we'll be able to use the area on the west that now is just a goose pasture.
Presumably, but things change day by day. So, yeah.
Other questions?